In the heart of a world torn by war, magic, and ancient grudges, Mother of Death and Dawn unfolds as the climactic finale to Carissa Broadbent's beloved fantasy series. This book has garnered a devoted following for its intricate character development and morally complex worldbuilding, with readers particularly drawn to the evolving relationship between T'Sana and Max. Since its 2022 release, the novel has become a book talk sensation, with fantasy enthusiasts praising its unflinching examination of trauma, recovery, and the possibility of redemption even in the darkest circumstances. What makes this story particularly compelling is how it refuses easy answers, asking instead what justice means when pursuing it might destroy everything worth saving. The story opens with T'Sana's desperate mission through the moonlit streets of Ara's capital, seeking to retrieve the Heartstone, a mysterious artifact of immense power. When she finally obtains it, the stone unexpectedly melts into her skin, creating intricate golden patterns across her palm that pulse with ancient magic. This seemingly straightforward theft becomes catastrophic when palace guards discover her, forcing her to flee alongside Melina, a kitchen slave who showed her kindness. Their frantic escape through the city's winding alleys ends in tragedy when Melina sacrifices herself to save T'Sana from the guards' arrows. Gravely wounded, T'Sana survives only through the intervention of Ishka, her loyal companion and fellow resistance fighter, who carries her to safety through the city's underground tunnels. Meanwhile, deep within Ilazoth, the haunting white tower that pierces Ara's skyline, Max endures a living nightmare. The tower's pristine walls hide horrors, rooms where reality shifts like quicksand, and corridors that seem to breathe. Queen Nura's experiments grow increasingly brutal as she attempts to unlock the deep magic she believes lies dormant within him. Stripped of both his memories and his considerable magical abilities, Max clings to sanity through an obsessive ritual, drawing three distinct shapes over and over: a spiral that seems to whisper of ancient powers, a triangle that burns in his dreams, and a circle that feels like home, meaningless to his captors, but resonating deep within his fractured psyche. The narrative's third thread follows Aife, once known as Rushikaye, whose very existence defies natural law. Resurrected by the enigmatic Fae King Kaduan, she grapples with an identity crisis that transcends normal understanding. Her soul, once intertwined with both T'Sana and Max, now exists independently yet remains connected to them through ethereal bonds. These connections manifest in vivid shared dreams. T'Sana might glimpse snow-covered mountains she's never seen, while Max finds himself remembering songs in languages he's never learned. Aife experiences both their emotions, a constant reminder of their unnatural separation. This supernatural triangle forms the story's foundation, three beings, once one, now separated but inextricably linked. Their connection manifests in unexpected ways: shared bursts of power, simultaneous headaches across continents, and dreams that blur the lines between their consciousness. T'Sana channels her portion of their shared power into leading a growing resistance movement, determined to free both Max and her enslaved people from Ara's oppression. Max's struggle to piece together his identity becomes more desperate as Queen Nura's experiments intensify, each recovered memory bringing both clarity and new questions. Aife, meanwhile, walks a precarious line between embracing Kaduan's offer of revenge against humanity and forging her own path, one that might reunite the three fractured pieces of their shared soul. Their individual quests, though seemingly separate, weave together into a tapestry that will determine not just their own fates, but the future of magic itself in their world. Max's imprisonment in Ilazoth represents one of the novel's most haunting elements. This isn't merely physical captivity, but a profound psychological torture. The tower itself seems sentient, erasing Max's ritualistic drawings and tormenting him with visions of a burning girl he can't quite recognize. Queen Nura's experiments involved tattooing magical stratagrams across his entire body, a violation that physically binds his power while symbolizing how thoroughly his autonomy has been stripped away. What makes this imprisonment particularly cruel is that Max doesn't even have his memories as refuge. Everything beyond age 17 has been erased, leaving him with only fragments that surface in nightmares or during moments of extreme stress. When he finally escapes Ilazath with his brother Brayan's help, he carries this mental prison with him, a man without a past, haunted by powers he doesn't understand and relationships he can't remember. The novel brilliantly uses this amnesia as both plot device and metaphor. Max's forgotten relationship with Tisana creates heartbreaking tension when they reunite. "What's your name?" he asks, watching her face collapse in shock and heartbreak. Yet his body remembers what his mind cannot. He's drawn to her scent, her presence, the shapes of her dual-toned face that match the mysterious pattern he's been compulsively drawing. This exploration of memory raises profound questions about identity. If Max can't remember his actions or relationships, is he still the same person? Is he responsible for things he can't recall? When he eventually learns he was responsible for his family's deaths while under Ra's al Ghul's influence, the revelation forces him to confront whether amnesia absolves him of guilt. The novel suggests that while memory may be fallible, the consequences of our actions remain etched in the world around us, demanding acknowledgement regardless of what we remember. Against the backdrop of personal struggles, Broadbent constructs a richly textured political landscape. Threl operates on institutionalized slavery, with noble houses like the Zarakovs maintaining power through brutal oppression. Ara, though nominally more progressive, exploits wielders like Max for military advantage. The Fae, led by King Caduin, harbor centuries of resentment against humans for past atrocities. Tisana's journey exemplifies the complex reality of revolution. Having escaped slavery herself, she's dedicated to liberating others, yet finds that overthrowing oppressors doesn't automatically create justice. When she helps establish the Alliance of Seven Banners from former Threlian territories, she confronts the messy reality of nation-building. "We need to focus on keeping our country from falling apart," she argues, when some push for wholesale slaughter of Threlians. The novel refuses easy solutions to systemic problems. When Max becomes Arch-Commandant of Ara, he immediately questions rebuilding the Orders, the very institution that once defined his identity. How can we continue an organization that sanctioned torture? This willingness to dismantle broken systems rather than reform them reflects the book's radical approach to justice. Sometimes structures are too corrupt to salvage. Perhaps most compelling is how the narrative explores the corrupting nature of power itself. Caduin, despite his noble intentions to protect the Fae, becomes increasingly willing to burn them all to the ground in the name of a single Fae life. Nora justifies her atrocities as necessary sacrifices for Ara's survival. Even our protagonists aren't immune. Tisana's desire to free Max leads her to reckless decisions that endanger others, while Max's quest for redemption sometimes blinds him to wider consequences. Through these political machinations, the novel asks, what price is too high for justice? When does righteous vengeance become indistinguishable from the original crime? These questions find no easy answers, reflecting the messy reality of power struggles throughout human history. Central to the conflict are the Lajaras, three ancient artifacts of immense power that can literally reshape reality. The first appears as a petrified heart that can transform one thing into another. The second manifests as an amber stone containing a fetus-like form that can create life. The third remains hidden in Ilazoth until the climactic finale. Together, they represent the ultimate power that all factions seek to control. The Lajaras function brilliantly as both plot devices and metaphors. On a narrative level, they drive the action as various characters race to claim them. On a symbolic level, they represent the three fundamental forces of existence: creation, destruction, and transformation. This trinity echoes throughout the novel in various forms: past, present, and future, body, mind, and soul, Tisana, Max, and Afe. What elevates the novel's treatment of magic is how it connects to deeper themes of responsibility. Using the Lajaras isn't simply about wielding power, it's about disrupting the natural order. As Vardir explains, the characters have torn holes in the layers of magic, causing it to bleed between realms. This creates a powerful metaphor for environmental destruction, short-sighted actions for immediate gain that threaten the entire ecosystem. The magic system also brilliantly reflects the characters' psychological states. Tisana's Valtaine magic withers and decays, mirroring how her trauma has taught her to survive by destroying threats. Max's Solari magic burns with destructive fire, paralleling his self-loathing and guilt. Afe's newfound ability to create delicate flowers contrasts with her violent past, representing her struggle to build rather than destroy. By the climax, the characters must make the ultimate sacrifice, sealing away the deep magic to heal the world's wounds. This act requires them to give up the very power that defined them, suggesting that true heroism sometimes means relinquishing power rather than wielding it. It's a profound statement in a genre that typically celebrates magical might, arguing instead for restraint and responsibility. Few fantasy novels engage with trauma as honestly as Mother of Death and Dawn. Each protagonist carries profound wounds that shape their actions and relationships in ways both subtle and devastating. Tisana bears both physical scars from her enslavement and psychological ones from years of abuse, nightmares that wake her screaming, flinching from unexpected touches, and a deep-seated mistrust of authority figures. Max's amnesia itself functions as a trauma response, his mind protecting him from unbearable memories of betrayal and violence. The gaps in his memory manifest as recurring headaches and emotional numbness whenever he approaches certain topics. Afife's entire existence is defined by centuries of exploitation, her body and magic used as weapons without her consent, leaving her struggling with questions of identity and autonomy. The novel never suggests these traumas can be simply overcome or forgotten. Instead, it portrays healing as a messy, non-linear process that requires both personal work and supportive relationships. When Lady Zorikov tortures Tisana by cutting squares of skin from her back, deliberately mirroring her previous abuse, it triggers intense flashbacks that leave her paralyzed for days. Yet through this ordeal, Tisana finds the strength to reject her abuser's narrative. "I killed you, and I destroyed your empire, and I don't need to think about you again." This moment represents not just personal triumph, but a reclamation of narrative power. Max's journey with his brother Brian illustrates how trauma affects relationships across generations. When Max finally confesses his role in their family's deaths, Brian's response is raw and realistic, not immediate forgiveness, but anger and withdrawal. "You let me believe that there had been justice for this." Their subsequent interactions are filled with tension, unspoken accusations, and painful silences. This honest portrayal acknowledges that healing often involves painful confrontations before reconciliation becomes possible. Through small gestures, shared meals, protective actions, and eventually honest conversations, they begin rebuilding their brotherhood. Perhaps most poignant is how the characters learn to love despite, or even because of, their scars. Tisana and Max don't love idealized versions of each other. They love precisely who they've become through their struggles. Their romance develops slowly, with careful attention to triggers and boundaries. They share nightmares and comfort each other through panic attacks, demonstrating that true intimacy includes sharing both light and darkness. As Max reflects, "Tisana and I don't love each other's illusions. We love each other's truths." This represents a profound message about acceptance, not just tolerating another's wounds, but embracing the strength and wisdom those wounds have created. The novel also explores collective trauma through its world-building. Communities bear the scars of war and oppression shown in their customs, superstitions, and the ways they protect their vulnerable members. Healing happens not just individually, but through communal rituals, shared stories, and the gradual rebuilding of trust between formerly warring peoples. At its core, Mother of Death and Dawn is a meditation on justice, vengeance, and whether redemption is possible after unforgivable acts. Each character grapples with these questions from different perspectives. Afe's initial position is uncompromising. "We destroy them," she declares about humans who have tortured her kind. Her rage is entirely justified given her centuries of suffering. Yet the novel doesn't shy away from showing how this righteous fury threatens to consume everything, including what she loves. Qatawan's vendetta against humanity similarly begins from legitimate grievances, the slaughter of his people, the destruction of Narajah, but gradually transforms him into what he hates. As Mieshka pointedly asks, why is Qatawan's vengeance acceptable when others is not? This question exposes the selective morality often applied to violence when it serves our own causes. Max represents the opposite extreme, carrying such overwhelming guilt that he questions whether he deserves any happiness. His journey involves learning that while atonement matters, endless self-punishment serves no one. When he finally accepts Tisana's love despite his past, it's not because he's earned it, but because he's committed to building something better going forward. The novel's most nuanced perspective comes from Tisana, who has every reason to seek vengeance, yet ultimately recognizes its limitations. When she finally confronts Lady Zorikov, she initially wants her to burn slowly for her crimes. Yet Max's gentle reminder, "This isn't you," brings her back from the brink. She still executes Zorikov, but cleanly rather than cruelly, refusing to become the torturer she herself once suffered under. This moral complexity extends to the final resolution. Rather than a simplistic "love conquers all" message, the novel suggests that sometimes justice requires sacrifice. Afe and Qatawan give their lives to seal away the deep magic, not because they've fully abandoned their cause, but because they recognize that unchecked vengeance would destroy everything, including what they're fighting for. It's a bittersweet conclusion that acknowledges both the legitimacy of their grievances and the necessity of finding another way forward. Amidst war and magic, the novel weaves several profound love stories that anchor the characters through their darkest moments. The central romance between Tisana and Max stands as one of the most emotionally resonant elements, a relationship tested by amnesia, war, and seemingly insurmountable obstacles. Their reunion after Max's imprisonment creates heart-wrenching tension. Tisana must face a lover who doesn't remember her, while Max experiences the disorienting sensation of physical and emotional connection to someone who feels like a stranger. Their gradual reconnection unfolds with exquisite care. Max drawn to her despite his missing memories, Tisana torn between protecting him from painful truths and honoring their shared past. When Max temporarily leaves for Besrith, their farewell captures the novel's bittersweet approach to love. Tisana tells him, "It was a gift to have known you. I hope you find a future worth forgetting your past." This selfless act, releasing him from obligation to their relationship, paradoxically strengthens their bond, as Max realizes he cannot walk away from what they've built together. Equally compelling is the complex relationship between Afe and Qaduan. What begins as manipulation evolves into genuine connection as Afe discovers her own identity separate from her past as Rishai. Their romance develops through small, tender moments, Qaduan teaching her to dance, Afe creating a tiny black rose in her palm, their shared understanding of ancient grief. When Qaduan falls ill from using forbidden magic, Afa's devastation is palpable. "You brought me here just to abandon me. You made me love you." These relationships aren't portrayed as perfect solutions to the character's problems. Instead, they represent anchors in a chaotic world, connections that provide purpose and meaning even when everything else falls apart. The novel suggests that love isn't about finding someone who completes you, but rather someone who witnesses your struggle and chooses to stand beside you anyway. Throughout the novel, creation and destruction exist in constant tension, intertwining like twin threads in a complex tapestry. This duality manifests most literally in the Legeras, powerful artifacts that wield both generative and destructive forces. These ancient tools can breathe life into barren wastelands, transform base matter into precious materials, or bring swift and merciless death. But beyond these concrete manifestations, the theme resonates through every layer of the narrative, raising profound questions about the cost of building something meaningful and what must be sacrificed to achieve it. Afeeb's journey embodies this tension with particular poignancy. Initially, her magic manifests purely as destruction. Her touch withers crops, her presence kills small animals, and her unleashed power levels entire cities with terrifying efficiency. The weight of this destructive capacity isolates her, making her fear even casual contact with others. Her breakthrough moment comes in a quiet garden when she creates a tiny black flower. Despite once leveling cities, nothing had ever brought me the pride of this single, living flower created solely by me. This small act of creation represents a profound shift in her understanding of power, from domination to nurturing, from taking life to giving it. The scene gains additional significance when we learn that the black flower becomes a symbol of hope among the resistance, its very existence proving that even those marked by destruction can learn to create. The novel also explores how destruction sometimes enables and occasionally necessitates new beginnings. When Max argues against rebuilding the towers after their fall, he recognizes that some institutions are too fundamentally corrupt to reform. The ancient power structures, despite their grandeur and history, must be completely dismantled to make way for something better. Similarly, the sealing away of deep magic represents both devastating loss and unprecedented opportunity, sacrificing godlike power to create space for a more balanced world where ordinary people can shape their destinies. As Tisana reflects in the epilogue, they have indeed built something better from the ashes of the old order, though the price was steep in blood and sacrifice. Perhaps most poignantly, the novel acknowledges the creation that comes from loss itself. After experiencing unimaginable suffering, the death of loved ones, the destruction of homes, the shattering of worldviews, the characters don't emerge unchanged. They're forged into something new, carrying both scars and wisdom. Max's reflection that his anxiety about losing his family is simply what it means to have something precious to lose, something to love, captures this duality perfectly. This bittersweet realization embodies the novel's core truth, that creation always carries the shadow of potential destruction, that love makes us vulnerable to loss, and that accepting this vulnerability is the price of a fully lived life. The characters learn that trying to avoid this price, by refusing to create, to love, to build, is itself a form of destruction. The epilogue unfolds 5 years after the war's devastating conclusion, revealing a transformed world through the lens of Tisana and Max's shared life. They've created a home in the rebuilt eastern quarter of Shadowhaven, where their two children, 5-year-old Kira and 3-year-old James, represent the possibility of new beginnings. Their domestic life intertwines with their broader mission. Tisana leads a pioneering school for both human and fae children, while Max helps establish the Craftsman's Guild that bridges ancient magical traditions with modern innovation. The scars of war persist beneath their hard-won peace. Max still wakes in cold sweats, haunted by memories of the Shadow Planes. Tisana's physical scars from her imprisonment remain, and certain sounds, like metal scraping against stone, can trigger moments of panic. Yet these challenges don't define them. Instead, they've learned to support each other through the difficult moments, demonstrating that healing isn't about erasing trauma, but learning to carry it while moving forward. What distinguishes this ending is its unflinching look at the complexities of post-war reconstruction. The newly formed Democratic Council faces constant challenges, mediating disputes between former enemies, establishing fair trade agreements, and dismantling centuries-old systems of oppression. In the southern provinces, where slavery persisted longest, resistance to change breeds tension. The integration of Fae and human communities proves especially challenging. Old prejudices die hard, and cultural misunderstandings frequently threaten fragile alliances. Tisana and Max approach these challenges with hard-earned wisdom. They've learned that meaningful change requires more than grand gestures or powerful magic. It demands countless small acts of courage, compromise, and compassion. Their school becomes a microcosm of this philosophy, where children from all backgrounds learn not just academic subjects, but the essential skills of empathy and understanding. The novel's emotional core crystallizes in Tisana's mother's final words: "You have survived, my daughter. Now live." This deceptively simple instruction carries profound weight. Through Tisana's journey from survival to truly living, we see how healing requires active choice, the daily decision to embrace joy despite past pain, to trust despite betrayal, to hope despite disappointment. Her mother's words become a mandate not just for personal healing, but for societal transformation. Mother of Death and Dawn concludes by threading this delicate balance between acknowledging trauma and embracing possibility. The story suggests that true strength lies not in the ability to forget or overcome past wounds, but in the courage to build something meaningful from them. Through Tisana and Max's example, we see how personal healing parallels societal reconstruction. Both require patience, persistence, and the willingness to embrace imperfect progress over the illusion of perfect solutions. In their world, as in ours, the most profound revolutions happen not in dramatic moments of conflict, but in the quiet, determined work of building connection, understanding, and hope in the aftermath of darkness.